needs to make people more aware of. But yes, it makes you feel empowered. We can't tell whether it's going to be a winning or losing difference. That depends what kind of effective coalition we build.
On that note, Tatanka Kitpricka, I want to thank you very much for joining us again on Politics or Pedagogy.
Thank you, John.
This is John Crumshaw for KPFK. You can always pledge your support at kpfk.org.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Good afternoon and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Esty Chandler. In July, as reported by the Department of Defense, three Guantanamo Bay detainees accused of plotting the 9/11 attacks in the U.S. and all who were previously tortured at CIA black sites, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged mastermind, had agreed to plead guilty to conspiracy and murder charges in return for assurances from prosecutors that they would not face the death penalty. The plea deal offered the prospect of a resolution to legal proceedings that have been mired for many years in pretrial arguments over whether evidence obtained from the defendants through torture was admissible in court. But just 2 days after the announcement, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin abruptly revoked the plea deal and relieved the negotiator in charge of their position after years of effort to reach an agreement to bring the cases to a close. Austin said in his memo on the matter that the responsibility for such a significant decision should rest with him alone. However, last month, Guantanamo Judge Colonel Matthew McCall overruled Secretary Austin's attempt to retroactively rescind those plea deals, saying that because Austin had deputized the head of the military court to make plea deals if they thought the plea deals were the right thing to do, he cannot take those powers back just because he disagrees with the decision. We are incredibly fortunate today to be joined by Clive Stafford Smith, a member of the Guantanamo Bar, who has secured the release of 86 Guantanamo detainees as of the taping of this show on Boxing Day, to update us on that case and several others he is involved with. Clive Stafford Smith is a dual UK citizen. He co-founded and previously directed the legal action charity, the Louisiana Capital Assistance Center in New Orleans, and is currently working with the Justice League. Since 1984, Clive Stafford Smith has represented over 400 people facing execution in the US and elsewhere, as well as bringing the first challenge to Guantanamo Bay prison, where he has secured the release of at least 86 detainees and working for a few more within the next few days and weeks as he continues to represent prisoners at that facility. In 2000, Clive was awarded the Order of the British Empire by Queen Elizabeth II for services to humanity. In my opinion, well-deserved. It is always my honor to welcome Clive Stafford Smith back to Middle East in Focus.
We just got to talk about that OBE nonsense, right? That was for my mom, because my mother, who did look a bit like Queen Elizabeth and was the same age, really wanted to go to Buckingham Palace and meet her. And the reason that sadly I'll probably never be invited back is because I took the opportunity to ask Her Majesty, when she was going to stop signing execution warrants in the Caribbean. And I think it came as a bit of a surprise that she was doing that.
Well, I'm sure you made your mom proud and then maybe pissed her off a little.
No, I made my mom proud. I maybe just pissed the Queen off a little. That's all right.
Okay. Well, with that, we have a ton to discuss. So let's jump in. I saw a bit of uplifting news from you earlier this week in the form of a tweet that read, quote, "Headed home after a really promising 3 weeks for Afia," end quote. Can you briefly tell us about Dr. Afia Siddiqui, a Palestinian woman who earned her bachelor's degree from MIT and her doctorate with the goal of helping children learn from Brandeis University? Can you tell us when and why your paths crossed and what you spent those 3 weeks doing here in the U.S.?
Yeah, sure. I mean, she's Pakistani, not Palestinian, but that's just a slip of the tongue. So she is someone whose case I only took on a couple of years ago, and I wish I'd done it earlier. I was in Pakistan, and I'd just got three of my Pakistani Guantanamo clients out, so stupidly I thought I had some extra time. Her fabulous sister, Dr. Fawzia Siddiqui, who is a neurologist trained at Harvard, had bullied me into taking the case on. I went to see Afia in Texas because I was there on a death case. And goodness, you meet this poor woman, you just can't not do it. She's the worst example of the abuses of the war on terror, or the war of terror, as Barrett calls it, that I've had anything to do with, and I've had a lot. And really, it's this. March the 30th, 2003, the CIA had paid a $55,000 bounty to the corrupt Pakistan government for them to turn over someone they thought was a big-time Al-Qaeda terrorist, Afia Siddiqui. If they'd just paused for 2 seconds, they would have realized that there were no women in the upper echelons of Al-Qaeda. It was just absurd. And she wasn't. But the CIA abducted her, not by herself, but with her three children. And the thing that's truly shocking is they appear to have dropped the youngest, Suleiman, aged 6 months, on his head and killed him. But they've never had the guts to admit that. And can you imagine what that would do to you? Then the other two kids, three-year-old Mariam, a U.S. citizen, the CIA takes her from Pakistan to a war zone in Kabul, forcibly adopts her into a white Christian American family on the obvious theory that better to be white Christian American than to be a Pakistani Muslim of color, I suppose. And she's stuck there for 7 years until she's rescued with the aid of Hamid Karzai, who's a witness to that if the CIA wants to deny it. Then the six-year-old, also a U.S. citizen named Ahmad, they took all the way to Kabul and put him in prison and changed his name to Ihsan Ali. And he's there for 5 years and told that if he ever says he's Ahmad, they'll kill him. And they took Afia to Bagram, where I've been and filmed where she was tortured, and made her watch children being abused, thinking that they were her kids. And of all the shocking things I've learned, there are thousands of them on this, that Afia, intelligent, brilliant woman, desperate to stop her children being abused, the only thing she could think of was to pretend she didn't care. That was the only way she thought she could stop these monsters from doing what they were doing. And frankly, of all the things I would like to see in Congress, and that was just one thing I was talking to the Congress people about, is a hearing about why the CIA thought that it was in our national interest to take two little children and torture them and abuse them the way they did. I mean, it's just disgusting. And the same with Afia. So she's now in prison. She was given 86 years on an utterly bogus charge. And I was in Washington for 3 weeks meeting with all that really impressive people, actually, in Congress and trying to get to the White House to get President Biden, beyond just pardoning his son and, you know, thankfully commuting 37 of the 40 federal death row prisoners, to show a little mercy on Afia so we can get her to a hospital in another country where she can get treated for the horrible trauma that she's suffered. That's the short version. I'm afraid my clemency petition was 76,000 words, so I'm not telling you the whole story.
Well, quickly, are there actions that people can still take towards this effort? Because I know that I've been doing some tweeting and sending out messages over social media.
Whatever anyone has any way in to get Biden to look at this seriously. I do think that President Biden, who's, you know, had difficult time losing a couple of children himself, who's a sincerely religious man, who realizes that certainly the Democrats haven't made any friends in the Muslim community. I think this is a good way that he can show the quality of mercy and hopefully begin to repair some of the damage that's been done by Gaza. So, you know, if anyone has those contacts, you're welcome to give out my email there.
So On December 17th, I awoke to read that the U.S. government had released Guantanamo Bay detainee Mohammed Abdul Malik Bajabu, repatriating him to Kenya, and I believe marking the first detainee transfer in over a year. I want you to tell us about him, but also on the following day, it was announced that two additional men were released. So can you tell us about those three releases that came, I think, actually on the same day?
Yeah, it did, really. The two guys who went to Malaysia were just going a bit further. And they were what were loosely termed high-value detainees. They were meant to be the baddest of the bad, but I think we finally worked out they weren't. The Abdul Malik, who I've represented for several years, was abducted in 2006 and brought to Guantanamo. And he was this guy, I really liked him. You know, he had a fabulous sense of humor. He was really, really an interesting person. And he was so distraught at what had happened that he got his wife to never tell his kids where he was. So he was there for 18 years, and he didn't want his children to know that the U.S. thought he was some sort of terrorist. And so I was really pleased. We got him cleared for release, actually well over a year ago now. And I was a bit worried that we wouldn't get him out because he has to go back to Kenya. But I was really so happy to hear that he had gone. And that takes Guantanamo down to 27 prisoners at an average cost of about now $17 million per year. This is your tax money. I hope you don't mind spending it on such an incredible waste of time. And I really, really hope that in the next few days, we're going to have another 14 go home, which will take the population of Guantanamo down to 13, and then we'll be spending over $30 million per prisoner per year. You know, I had one of my clients write an essay about how he would spend his $30 million if he had it, instead of the way we waste it. My client, I'm glad to say, said he was going to rent the whole top floor of the Trump Towers in New York, and let the guards live in luxury while they looked after him. And I was really pleased that he decided he would give $1 million to my nonprofit, the Justice League. Which, you know, that's good. I don't think I'm ever going to see that money, but that was a nice idea.
You're listening to Middle East in Focus on listener-supported KPFK in Los Angeles. I'm SD Chandler, enormously grateful to be joined on this holiday weekend by Clive Stafford Smith, member of the Guantanamo Bar, co-founder and previous director of the legal action charity Louisiana Capital Assistance Center in New Orleans, about the case of Dr. Afia Siddiqui, the releases of three Guantanamo detainees this month, ethics complaints he filed against U.S. government prosecutors, and Defense Secretary Austin's revocation of a plea deal negotiated to settle the cases of three Guantanamo Bay detainees accused of plotting the 9/11 attacks. Clive, I want to go back to June when The Intercept reported on the hearing in the case of Abdulrahman al-Nashiri, who is charged with masterminding the October 2000 attack on the USS Cole. That story begins with allegations you made when you were called to the witness stand by al-Nashiri's defense team, which leads you, for the first time, as I read, in 40 years, to filing ethics complaints against the U.S. government prosecutors trying the case against al-Nashiri. So can you tell us about the quote-unquote outrageous misconduct that pushed you to take that very serious step after everything you've witnessed in over 20 years of representing Guantanamo Bay prisoners?
Well, it goes back 40 years on all the death penalty cases, and I've got to say, I've never felt I had to report people to the bar. I think that's a tough thing to do, and I'm not a big fan of doing it. But what happened in that case was I represented a guy called Ahmed Rabbani, who is a Pakistani. And Ahmed had been taken to the dark prison and tortured. He had made various statements that were patently false. And when Donald Trump was last president, the only way to get your client out of Guantanamo was to cut a deal to be a snitch, effectively. And so the prosecution came to me saying, you know, they got these statements from Ahmed. Would he be willing to testify? And if he was, they'd let him go. So I went to talk to Ahmed, and I knew what he was going to say, that everything in his statements was nonsense. And I said to him, I said, look, I'm never, ever going to tell you to commit perjury. But you know and I know that the last guy they did this with, a guy called El Darbi, committed perjury and got to go back to Saudi Arabia. And that's a moral decision for you. He said, and I really respect this, he said, look, I've suffered here for years. He was on hunger strike for 7 years, force-fed every day. And he said, I'm not going to lie to get out of this place. That's just not my moral code. So anyway, I said to the prosecutors, you know, you're welcome to questioning him. You know, he's happy to talk to you, but I wouldn't hold your breath that he's going to say what was in your statements. So we spent days and days, me and a co-counsel, sitting there while they interrogated him about everything, and he told what he knew. And every time we came to these things they really wanted to hear, he said, no, you were torturing me. That was false. That just didn't happen. So then I got Ahmed out, got him back to Karachi, and we had a nice return celebration for him. And then the government submits against al-Nashiri in a death penalty case statements that they say are, quote, reliable hearsay from Ahmed Rabbani that they full well knew he had said were lies and that had been tortured out of him. So I wrote to him and I said, you can't do this. You know, this is just wrong, wrong, wrong. And they didn't withdraw it. So in the end, I reported them to the bar because I think you just can't do that. You can't wait until the witness is no longer there and then try and get totally false hearsay in against this poor guy to get him executed. So I testified. I don't like being a witness. It's much more fun being a lawyer, frankly. But, you know, I don't like people patronizing me on the witness stand and the judge telling me I can't respond properly. So anyway, I testified to just the truth as I knew it. And I'm really glad to say that the judge, you know, these judges in Guantanamo are not known to be soft pinko liberals. This judge suppressed the statements saying, indeed, they were the fruit of torture and the government has no business using them. Now, you know, what happens to the prosecutors for doing that? I don't know. I suspect very little, because very rarely do prosecutors get sanctioned for doing things like that. But really, they shouldn't do it. They're sworn to uphold the U.S. Constitution just like I am.
Never a dull moment.
No, there really isn't. I've got to say, they keep me entertained, even though it's shocking.
Yeah, I would agree with that word. Okay, now to the story that I outlined in the opening. Secretary Lloyd Austin's revocation, or at least attempted revocation, of the plea deal negotiated to settle the cases of three Guantanamo Bay detainees accused of plotting the 9/11 attacks. I'm guessing that outcries from members of Congress claiming the Biden administration was going soft on terrorists, as well as objections from families of 9/11 victims, might have had something to do with Secretary Austin's about face. The Guardian has reported that the Pentagon is planning to appeal Judge Colonel Matthew McCall's ruling, and the Defense Department would seek postponement of any hearing on those pleas. So what can you tell us about the status of those cases as we now approach the 22nd anniversary of the opening of the illegal Guantanamo Bay prison camp on January 11th? And is there any chance that this case could be wrapped up before Trump takes office again?
Well, look, let me say two things first. First, I'm not directly representing those guys. I've consulted on them, but I don't want to pretend that I'm here talking about certainly things that might be classified. And the second is that, you know, clearly there's been a huge amount of work by both sides to resolve these cases because here we are, 23 years now from 9/11, and they haven't achieved any meaningful convictions in Guantanamo. They put the poor victims through all sorts of craziness. And yeah, there might be some people who are willing to keep pursuing it in the desperate hope of the death penalty. But a lot of the victims of 9/11 and their families, rather, that I've talked to actually really want some resolution. And part of this plea deal was that Hala Sheikh Mohammed would be willing to take questions from them about why he did this mad act or claims to have done it. But then there's an underlying story which illustrates everything that's wrong with Guantanamo. In my view, and this, you know, I'm just telling you what my view is, this whole deal was meant to go down after November the 5th, after the election. No one in their right mind was going to put this deal down any more than a bunch of these clemency things before November the 5th. And so that was when it was going to happen. Now, why did it happen before that? In my view, it happened before that because there were certain members of the prosecution who were firm Trumpites and they were playing politics. So they wanted to do it ahead of the whole election just to try to score points for Trump. So they make this happen at a moment that's politically mad. Obviously, the defense is going to go along with anything because their clients want to do this. But then Lloyd Austin is in a position of trying feverishly to backtrack because this is all political. And this is what's happened throughout Guantanamo Bay. It's not a real court. It's not a real legal system. It was made up on April 30th, 2003, and no one's had a proper trial ever since it was made up. So I was proud, actually, that this military judge said, no, 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 you can't play these political games. It's just wrong. And says he's going to enforce the plea agreement. Now, ironically, the government wants to appeal that when they wrote this silly system, they specifically didn't include a pre-verdict appellate remedy. So they can't appeal. Now, you know, they're the ones who wrote this silly system up. They're the ones who are now hoist on their own petard of not having an appellate system. And I think the whole thing will get resolved one way or the other. I can only tell you this, that if it doesn't get resolved before Donald Trump becomes president, and if his people don't go along with it, it's going to drag on until all of us die of old age. So it would be far better for everyone concerned if we could just get some sort of resolution out of this.
Dare I ask you to surmise what the Trump administration, obviously they're not going to move to close Guantanamo Bay, but...
Well, last time... President Trump said he was going to pack it with bad dudes. And you know, the only person they arrested and briefly put in a cell during that whole term that Trump had was one general, an American general, who was the head of the military defense team, who got thrown in jail for some form of contempt. You know, this place, it's a stain on the reputation of America. I brought the very first case against it, Rasul versus Bush. And I did that because I think that we as a country are better than that and that, you know, we're meant to have a system that's the rule of law. And, you know, there was a guy back in 2004, an intelligence agent, who said for every prisoner we've had in Guantanamo, we have inspired or provoked 10 people to want to do us harm because they say we're just hypocrites. Well, I think that same person would have a much bigger number now. You know, you see those people in ISIS, the mad people who then dress their prisoners up in Guantanamo orange and then, you know, cut their heads off or some craziness. Guantanamo has been a really, really damaging concept from the beginning. And the sooner that we put it behind us and just accept it was a mistake, the better.
Well, that's certainly true. I just fear some of the people that Trump is attempting to put in his cabinet might try to...
Well, look, dear old Donald says he wants to have torture back again and all the rest of it. Now, you know, I sincerely hope that he's just saying that for the crowd. I think it's madness to say that for the crowd because the leader of the United States shouldn't be doing that. But, you know, torture should be left in the Middle Ages where it belongs. And so let's just hope they don't get serious about that. If they do, we'll stop them.
And in our last 2 minutes, I wonder if there's anything you'd like to say about these 13 prisoners that you still have hopes of getting out before January 20th.
Well, yeah, the majority of them are from Yemen. I represent one directly. And we had an agreement to get them out of there in October of 2023, just when the crazy stuff happened in Gaza. And so they stopped the transfer of these guys from Guantanamo based on Gaza. I mean, why is that logical? Why is that legal? So I sincerely hope that's going to happen in the next couple of weeks. Let's keep our fingers crossed.
Well, we're going to keep our fingers crossed for them. Also for Dr. Siddiqui, which just seems like such an obvious case for the Biden administration to remedy. And as always, we will continue following your work because I don't know, is every December this busy for you?
Oh, yes, yes. There's all sorts of other stuff coming up. Don't worry, we can always come back on. Next time, we'll talk about the 800 people who have been sentenced to death for blasphemy in Pakistan, where I'm trying to help, you know. I don't know if you've blasphemed today, Estee, but if you have, we should probably execute you right now.
I probably have. And so we will definitely have you back on to talk about that and all the other things that happen in the next few weeks, because I'm sure there will be plenty. I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your weekend to join us. And we look forward to speaking with you again very soon.
Thank you very much.
The imprisoners at Guantanamo are, of course, agents of the U.S. government. But who are the prisoners? Since January 11, 2002, at least 780 prisoners from 48 countries have been incarcerated at Guantanamo Bay prison camp, all Muslim men. The youngest was 15, and the oldest, 75-year-old Saifulla Paracha, who was released home to Pakistan after being held for 18 years without being charged. According to Human Rights Watch, only 16 of the 780 prisoners have ever been charged with a crime. Let that sink in. How do we each use the awesome privileges of American citizenship to end this blight on our nation? Constitution signer James Wilson suggests it is the duty of every citizen to use our, quote, best and most unremitting endeavors, end quote, for preserving the Constitution, noting that the efforts of each and every one of us is important. So what will you do? Once again, I want to thank our guest, member of the Guantanamo Bar, and previous director of the legal action charity, the Louisiana Capital Assistance Center in New Orleans, currently a member of the Justice League, Clive Stafford Smith. I also want to thank Mark Maxwell for his production support today. Our theme song is The Overture from Summer Night's Dream by Marcel Khalife. For KPFK Los Angeles, I'm Estee Chandler, wishing everyone a safe and restful holiday season, and thanking you for supporting KPFK and taking this time to put the Middle East in focus.
I'm Chuck Foster, host of Reggae Central right here on KPFK. Join me Sunday afternoons from 2 to 5 for 3 hours of the best in ska, rocksteady, roots and culture, dub and dancehall, from the foundational Jamaican recordings to the latest international releases. That's Reggae Central 2 to 5 p.m. every Sunday right here on KPFK.
As the go-to media outlet for Southern California progressive thinkers since 1959, KPFK is very proud of its legacy. But maintaining that legacy can be expensive. Become part of the KPFK community today by donating at kpfk.org. Just click on the Support KPFK button on the website to send your gift today. Because while ignorance can be costly, speaking truth to power is priceless.
Hello and welcome to Radio Intifada, a production of the Suwannee Region Radio Collective that broadcasts and podcasts this weekly review of politics and culture, bringing you the voices of the voiceless